Greetings and welcome to the latest edition of the Entheogenic Evolution Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Martin, and I'm happy to have you with me today as I am joined once again by author, psychedelic historian, roller derby extraordinaire, Tom Hatzis. He's been a guest on the podcast several times before, talking about his previous books, The Witch's Ointment and Psychedelic Mystery Traditions, as well as had his talks from various events I've organized here in Southern Oregon that I've recorded and put out here on the podcast. So Tom has been here many times, and he's here again. We have a nice, long, lengthy conversation talking about his latest book, LSD, The Wonder Child, getting into the fantastic 50s and some of the early history of LSD and psychedelic research in the West. And of course, also be talking a little bit about mescaline and about psilocybin and even nitrous oxide. So check it out. Coming up in just a minute here. I would love to say that I have lots of people to thank for supporting the podcast this week, but I have no one. So I have nobody to thank this week. If you would like to support this podcast, there are two very easy ways to do it. One is through a PayPal donation, and another is by joining up as a member at my Patreon page. Both are accessible through my main website, www.martinbald.net. There's a PayPal link at the top right, and also a link to my Patreon page, which is patreon.com/martinwball. There's a variety of levels that you can sign up for with a monthly contribution, with whatever fits your budget and your interest and your level of support. Also, just want to remind people that my latest book is now currently out there and available. It's in paperback and Kindle ebook. The book is A Sleep Story, an unintentional exploration of the altered states of being awake. And it is a medical autobiography dealing with my life and history with a chronic sleep disorder. And all kinds of stuff also about psychedelics and entheogens and personal experiences all in there, but it's primarily about sleep. So if you're interested, I encourage you to check it out. Well, nothing more to announce at the moment, so let's go ahead and get into our interview with Tom Hatzis. Here it is. We spoke just a couple days ago, and here it is for all of you in listener land. Please enjoy. I miss seeing people in person. I like being able to see people on my computer, but it's nice to see you, Tom. And, you know, it's been a while since I've actually seen you. God, it's probably been like 2018 since I've seen you in person now.
Yeah, probably.
So it's been a while, and you've been a busy guy. You've been writing and releasing all kinds of books, and we're here today to talk about your new book, LSD, The Wonder Child, The Golden Age of the Psychedelic Research in the 1950s by Tom Hatzis. Yay! And I actually just, I'd read it pretty thoroughly last week, but I just had one more chapter. So I had the very last chapter to read, and I did that today. So I've successfully read all of your book. And of course, I've read The Witch's Ointment and The Psychedelic Mystery Traditions. And you are now, you're one of the most featured persons here on the Entheogenic Evolution podcast, because
because
we've talked about your books, and then of course you've been at many of the events that I've organized and given talks, and those have been put out here on the podcast. So you might be number one.
I'm gonna say that probably either Merrill or Rock is number one. That would be my guess, but hey, maybe I'm number one. That's cool too.
Well, you've written more books than either one of them, so
that's true.
Yeah. So it's, you know, my take on it is it's a great book. I really love the fact that I know you, because in reading the book, it's like, I hear you, I see you, you know, it's like, oh yeah, this is so Tom. This is so Tom. This is great. So I really love that your personality really shines through. And I think it was in the foreword, or maybe it's somewhere on the back. It's on the back with Andy Letcher, and he says that Hatzis nonetheless wears his scholarship lightly. Reading this is like tripping with your professor, an invaluable and eminently readable contribution to psychedelic history. And yeah, I kind of feel the same way, that you're both scholarly, and just your own humor and your own point of view really shines through.
It's scholarship but with fart jokes.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's dig into it.
sure.
There's so many different things that we can talk about that you write in this book. And maybe let's just start with, you know, I mentioned on Facebook that I was reading your book and going to be interviewing you. And I think somebody commented like, well, what more does anybody have to say about LSD? So maybe let's start there. You know, what is the focus of the book? And why did you want to go about writing this particular book and kind of, and you talk about the origins of it. So maybe we could start there, but you know, wherever you want to jump in on those points.
Sure. So the book originates back in 2007, when I was writing my master's thesis, and the book is just an expanded edition of the master's thesis. And the penultimate chapter on Leary is actually my undergraduate thesis. So both my graduate and undergraduate theses are in that book. So in answer to that question and sort of to answer what that person commented, what more is there to say? Well, the truth is back in 2007 and 8, there was still a lot more to say. So I don't even necessarily disagree with that comment. When I originally wrote it, like a lot of these things, I mean, now it's difficult to think about, you know, how these things were not in our paradigm. Like, so in, let's just say for argument's sake, in 2007, 2008, nobody was talking about integration.
Yeah.
That word has come up in the past few years. But in the 1950s, they were talking about integration all the time. So when I brought that into my master's thesis, it was new information. Now it's not so much, you know, because we've heard of that term. And I just wanted to show mostly with the book that so many of the paradigms that we hold about psychedelia that we place in the 1960s actually originated in the 1950s. I mean, as one rather famous example, the word psychedelic, as you know, was coined in the 1950s.
Yeah.
But something else that I don't know is as common is that the word trip was also coined in the 1950s and was actually coined by a CIA agent or somebody working for MKUltra. I don't know, you know, what direct relation they had, but the earliest, I think it was from 1952, was a document that they said the report of the subject's trip in quotation marks. And I couldn't find anything earlier than that for, you know, for that word. So also things like the idea of dose, set, and setting. We tend to tie that to the 1960s because, of course, Leary was a loud proponent of dose, set, and setting. I mean, he completely ignored those rules, but he still was somewhat of a mouthpiece for them. But they originate in the 1950s. You can make the case that it originates way back in history with the different pagan rituals and stuff. But I mean, our modern understanding of people actually paying attention to the dose, the mindset of the person, and the setting of the room took place as early as 1951, 2, 3, around there.
Yeah. So you've got all this very interesting history about all of these topics in there. And let's just talk a minute about, how did Tom Hassis decide that he wanted to be a psychedelic historian? Because I think it's a very interesting role that you're sort of fulfilling within psychedelic culture, of this title of psychedelic historian. Of course, that has been the focus of your other books so far, like with The Winch's Ointment. You're really looking at indigenous European traditions and use of, you know, the various nightshades and henbanes and, you know, all of that stuff. And then your book, Psychedelic Mystery Traditions, is kind of looking at these, you know, much older traditions, you know.
Yeah.
But this is all much more up to date. But this, interestingly, this is, well, it's not completely up to date. I mean, it's from 1950s, 1960s.
Yeah.
But you know, just based on your description, that this is where you started as a psychedelic historian, was looking at these questions and looking at these topics. So I'm just kind of curious about your own education and how you kind of cultivated, like, yeah, this is what I want to do, is be a psychedelic historian, and really a historian who's grounding his material on primary documentation and evidence, you know, translations, original documents. So not based on some of the more speculative, like, oh, this looks like a mushroom, so it must be a mushroom, or, you know, but really trying to dig into what evidence do we have and how are these things used? And also, you've made some very interesting arguments about how different visionary plants and substances have been used for very different purposes in very different historical contexts, and really historicizing it in a very interesting way. So, yeah, tell us a little bit of how this all formulated within your own mind.
Sure. So I ate mushrooms for the first time when I was 18, and it was love at first bite. I mean, I was like, this is, I loved it. It was amazing. And the first thing I wanted to do was, okay, I want to go to college and study. Like, I wanted, like, I had, my first mushroom experience was a breakthrough mystical experience. And so I was like, okay, I have seen the mind of God. I have, you know, I have swum through the cosmos. So I, my first idea was, I want to write a book that demonstrates the mathematical probabilities of how mushrooms invigorate the soul, for lack of a better way of putting it. Now, since I don't know a goddamn thing about organic chemistry or math or cosmology, that threw big monkey wrenches into my plan. So I couldn't actually write that book. And I'd always had a fascination with not just solving like problems, but I really like textual criticism. Like you meant, like I love reading the primary source texts, mostly because that's, if you're not doing that, you're not playing by the rules of history. Like you ask, like, why do I go to those sources? Well, because of rule number one in any historical analysis, you want multiple contemporary attestation for what it is you're talking about. And so that's why I go to those records. If you're, you know, investigating something that happened in 1400 in wherever, Bern, Germany, or wherever, like just some place in Europe in 1400, well, looking to the Aztec use of mushrooms, you know, a century before or after, that's not going to give you any insights to what these people were doing over here. Unfortunately, with a lot of psychedelic research, and we both know people that do this, there's a lot of this, oh, look, they were using mushrooms over here. Oh, look, they're using mushrooms over there. Okay, well, obviously, these people right here, even though we don't have any evidence, they're using mushrooms too. And it's like, no, that's not how culture works. So I wanted to get in, and I actually learned this tactic from reading Andy Letcher's book, Shroom. Where there was something that he wrote that stuck out to me to this day, and this is going back 12, 13 years or so, that, you know, if you're going to look for these kinds of psychedelic traditions or psychoactive or whatever kind of traditions, you have to take each one of them in their own place and time. You can't assume that the people you are looking at or investigating from 700 years ago in a totally different part of the world have a similar thought about these medicines as you do, because many times they did not. And so that's something that I've tried to cultivate in my own writing. So thanks, Andy Letcher, for teaching us really, and by us, I mean the psychedelic renaissance, you know, how to really look at these in a response, look at these little morsels and tidbits of psychedelic history in a more responsible way.
Yeah. Well, kind of in a similar yet somewhat different arena, that I've kind of talked about this idea of the perennial philosophy in pretty much the same way that, you know, and maybe we can get into this when we talk about Huxley, but, you know, the idea, there's this idea in philosophy and religious studies that there's the perennial philosophy that says, and this is really, really popular, I would say, among New Age spiritual people, this idea that all religions point back to the same source. They're all about the same experiences. And like, even in my latest book, you know, that I'm writing about my sleep disorder, that I have a line in there saying that, in my opinion, only a fool thinks that all religions point back to the same source, and that they just haven't studied religion enough,
because exactly.
Religions are so different from each other. I mean, there are commonalities, there are some common themes, but what strikes me is how really radically different they are and how historically contextualized they all are, that we can't look at what Christians or Buddhists were doing 200 years ago and say it's the same thing that they're doing today in a culture that's completely different from where that all started, that it was a different social, cultural, political, religious mix at the time. And people were having experiences that related to that culture of that time. But we are not that culture. We're not that time anymore. So I personally think that the whole perennial philosophy is just garbage because, it's just, you're not learning enough about the actual religions if you just say it's all universal, it's all the same, and it all leads back to the same source. It's just naive, I think.
Yeah, I agree totally with you, and I'm saying that from the perspective of somebody that you now know because you read my book. I'm a huge Aldous Huxley fan.
Yeah.
But I think the perennial philosophy, it's like, yeah, it's the same reason that there are no mushrooms in Christian art. It's the same problem. It's the what's called the continuity hypothesis. And as much as I really loved my friend and colleague Brian Murarescu, his book The Immortality Key, I really enjoyed it, but I got to be honest, like, his defense of the continuity hypothesis, it's like, no, dude, like, no. It's like there's no – pretty much everything you just said. Sorry. Like, I'm about to just repeat what you said, but which is – pointless.
Well, I haven't read that book, so I'm not familiar with that phrase, continuity hypothesis.
Yeah, it's the same. It's the idea that, the whole Allegro Wassonian idea that, you articulated it perfectly, that all of these things go back, to the font, so to speak.
Yeah.
Ob font is, I think, the Latin. And yeah, that it all goes back to the same kind of wellspring that everybody is drinking from. And it's like, no, it doesn't. And that's the problem with Jerry Brown's work. That's a problem with a lot of faulty psychedelic history. The whole Santa Claus mushroom thing, that's part of the, oh, it continued on from Siberia. No, it didn't. Like, we know how all those things formed.
Yeah.
Like, we have perfectly good explanations. And unfortunately, we are kind of sadly living in a post-fact world, which is really scary if you value truth. Like, it's awful.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I'm just trying to hopefully bring facts back to the table. But you get yelled at for doing that these days. People don't really, they're not interested in facts anymore.
No,
they want to feel good.
Yes,
about what
yes.
They believe.
Yes, people are much more interested about feeling what they believe and having that upheld. And it's really frustrating for people who actually are interested in reality, whether it's, cosmological, metaphysical reality, whatever that may be, or if we're just talking about historical realities, or if we're even fucking talking about what actually happened on January 6th in Washington, D.C. It's just, oh my God, it's so frustrating. I mean, we just live in this post-fact. Everybody's feelings are just as equal as everybody else's reality. And it's really, really, it's deeply frustrating and deeply troubling, I think, for everyone.
It can't end well.
No.
That's the thing. Like, there's no way that eschewing facts for your personal beliefs will ever... That's not going to, especially like with math, I mean, on little levels here and there, like whatever, my favorite color is blue, yours is red, we could disagree, who gives a shit. But on like larger things, like whether vaccines work, for example, which just to be clear on my position, they do.
I'm right there with you. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, they work, and we're so lucky to have these things because several hundred years ago they didn't, and way more people got sick and died. So, but in a post-fact world, and that's where it becomes dangerous, as you correctly surmised. It's dangerous to not believe that or to not know that. But
yeah.
Oh, we're so much fun, aren't we? The most chipper.
I know.
Psychonauts.
Well, oh God, it's like, this is just my frustration that's coming out here, that even, who am I going to bring on to interview on the podcast? And like, one of the things that I'm thinking about now is like, God, am I going to get some anti-vaccine nut? And, because I've made a few posts on social media, not many, about my position on vaccines and coronavirus. And then just people come back and they're just like, Oh, well, this is why you're not relevant anymore, and you should just stick to licking toads. And oh, I used to respect you, but it's like, my God, it's like people are just so. I don't even know what they are. People are
You know
fucking
what it
losing their
is,
minds.
Martin? If only you weren't part of the sheeple,
Yeah.
then you would understand. It's that,
I know. I
that's what
know.
your problem is. And what it is if they got trains and led people away to vaccination camps, of course you would get on that because, you
Yeah.
lib loser, you.
Because I've bought into this system.
You libtard motherfucker.
Yeah.
No, it's ridiculous, but that's the post-fact world. And some of us were hoping that maybe psychedelia would help actually right that ship. But so long as we have outlets like Symposia out there, I mean, there's just going to be misinformation spread, all throughout the psychedelic renaissance. Because I mean, talk about post-fact.
Yeah.
You got those. Geniuses. But yeah.
Yeah, it's all about what you feel.
Yeah,
Well,
it's
that's my
feel.
feeling on the matter, so must be true. But
Yeah.
in going through your own schooling, did you find that your professors were supportive of doing this kind of research and looking at these questions, or I know that
Some were, some were.
your degree is a little bit more recent than mine, so I always talk about how, like, when I was getting my degree in religious studies, like, psychedelics, like, virtually never came up. Like, maybe two times in the 6 years I was in graduate school, it actually came up, like, in class or in the reading. But for the most part, it just wasn't even under consideration.
Sure. So I didn't have a Professor X the way you did
Yeah.
or anything like that. Some of my professors were, okay, with my undergraduate thesis, I wrote that on Timothy Leary. And one of my professors was is actually a descendant of Ponce de Leon, like the guy, the Fountain of Youth guy. His name is Charles Ponce de Leon. He actually teaches at UC Long Beach now. He hated my guts, but I learned so much from him because of that. And when I first presented the first draft of my undergraduate thesis to him, it was favorable towards Leary. I mean, and he just ripped me to shreds on the whole thing. And but in doing that, he taught me critical thinking, and he was the guy that taught me critical historical methodology. And he did it by wringing my ass out and belittling me and making me feel like shit as often as he possibly could. But it's weird because he did a great thing. Because without him, I think that I would be one of those people today that believes that I can just Google wisdom or I could just Google knowledge or anything like that. And this is going back to when the internet first came out. So people weren't really doing that yet, but that's where we are today, where it's like, any, like I say to people all the time, look, like you can Google that the world is flat. You can Google that the Holocaust never happened. So I don't give a shit about your ability to Google. What I care about is can you actually put information together in a way that demonstrates a point you're trying to make? And because of cell phones really just not only destroying people's personalities, but their ability to think critically, it's just getting kind of more and more frustrating out there. And I hope we reach a breaking point with all this soon. I don't know what that would look like, and I don't want it to be violent or anything, but I would really like to see people just kind of clap back at this bullshit. Kind of the way, not to bring it up again, the way when Symposia went after you, and pretty much collectively, we were all just like, no, fuck you, no, you're not doing this to Martin. You know what I'm saying? And it worked, one, because the charges against you were completely ludicrous, but it also worked because it's like, no, like we're not going to allow you to just tear this fucking man down over bullshit, over your fucking dog whistle terms, which is what they were doing. And I don't know. I got a little happy about that, about seeing just the outpouring of love and support for you in the face of this gross mischaracterization of who you actually are. And I just hope that in the future, everybody, kind of rallies you know, in that way again. Like, just to, and I'll wrap up with this, like, so months ago, maybe 6-7 months ago, I saw, you know, James Gesso had actually made a post about it and how he had been scared to, like, say anything.
Right.
Because for, and it's like, yo, James Gesso is one of the sweetest dudes. That dude should not ever be scared to speak his mind because he's smart. He's articulate. He has a good heart, and his, a voice like his, nobody's voice should ever be silenced. But the fact that, like, that dude, he shouldn't be worried to speak his opinion. And the fact that he was, it's like, that's so telling. It's like, is this really the world we want? Is this what we want psychedelic culture to be? We're all scared to talk to each other. Is that what we want our culture to be? Because if so, fuck it, I'm out.
Yeah. Yeah. That it really does create a climate of fear and intimidation.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I mean, I'm feeling kind of emotional as you're talking about all this because, you know, I had to go. It's okay. But, you know, it's, I had to go through all this shit. And, you know, the result really, I mean, I know we're getting off topic of your book, but so I'm
That's
sorry.
Fine.
It's your interview, but you know, we're talking about it.
I'd rather we just bullshit anyway. Yeah.
But you know, the result is that because of the fear that I do think that the work of Symposia did in some degree effectively get me blacklisted because of the fear, not because of anything that I've actually done. But
sure.
Because of the fear of, oh, is this going to create some kind of social media shitstorm or something like that? So that, you know, it's just, it's easier to leave Martin out than it would be to include me.
Now, I remember from LAMPS, they did that, right? The LAMPS conference.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I almost said something about that because they had, what's his name, Daniel Pinchbeck was on stage. And I was about to start something, but I didn't because I have a lot of respect for Brad Adams. So I didn't do it, but I was about to, I'm not going to say it because I don't want to blow this up, but I was going to say something just about the fact that Daniel Pinchbeck, who is like actually an abuser, an admitted abuser, he's on stage, but Martin is not for not doing anything or. Oh, this was before that. This was after the whole Octavio thing, I think.
Yeah. But
whatever the case may be, it's like, it's, I don't know. I don't like that kind of stuff. I don't like the idea of, you know, the whole blacklisting people or the cancel people thing. I mean, it's really, it's so disgusting and it's very disturbing. You know, we all, like, everybody makes mistakes, and this idea that you're supposed to be, we're all supposed to be judged by our admittedly regrettable worst moments is absurd. It's absurd. Like, everybody has fucked up. Everybody. Like, I don't judge people by their worst deed. I judge them by their best deed.
Yeah. Or judging people by the way they make other people feel.
Yeah, of course. I mean, mostly my whole thing is this. I have it down to three things and in no particular order. How you treat the planet, how you treat humans, how you treat animals. That is the only thing I give a shit. I don't care what your political stance is. I don't care what your religious stance is. If you go march for women's rights and then you kick a puppy, you're a piece of shit. I don't care if you just march for women's rights. You just hurt a fucking innocent animal. So that's my whole take, is just how you treat the world, animals, and people. And other than that, I don't give a fuck.
All right. Well, let's get back into history.
Sure.
You,
that's was a line from Bill and Ted's. Bill, my friend. Yes, Ted, my friend. Let's get back in, or let's go back in history. Sorry.
Let's go back in history.
You just took me back to when I was like 9 years old. That was one of my favorite movies. So,
yeah. So, you know, the book is sort of, it's about, as you term it, the Fantastic 50s and LSD, but definitely we have a few other, supporting characters in the story. We have mescaline. We've got psilocybin. We've got a little bit of nitrous oxide, right? Going back to people like William James. And then there's a few other things that you mention in the book. So it's like, well, I don't know what the hell that is.
Like carbogen?
Yeah, yeah. and it's all part of sort of this forgotten history, or just maybe, I don't know if it's forgotten or just not really well known, because I think it really did get overshadowed by people like Timothy Leary and then what did happen in the 60s and kind of the explosion of psychedelic culture and how it had left. It had been being cultivated in very academic circles, therapeutic circles, philosophers, you know, the literati, you know, all these people who are of generally high intelligence, people very curious about the nature of the mind, about the nature of perception, the nature of reality, and you know, then all, you know, it all got spilled over with Timothy Leary. But
also, just one thing, not to interrupt, yeah. I apologize, but just because this is overlooked a lot too. Yes, those people in the 50s were all of that. They were also the big C word, conservative. They were all very conservative.
Very interesting.
And that was something else that I found why I wanted to write the book, to get back to one of your previous questions, is to show it's like, yeah, like there was a time when literally Christian conservative right-wing Republicans were fucking gung-ho about LSD. They loved it. So anyway,
And it wasn't a countercultural thing at that point. It was
not at all.
It was an avant-garde intellectual investigation. So maybe we could trace some of this back to William James, who was this American philosopher, who, you know, he wrote this book, The Varieties of Religious Experience. And for him, it was about, he felt an access point into that. It was something that most people wouldn't even think about today, was like nitrous oxide. And he's like, I'm, you know, sucking on nitrous oxide and I'm having these religious experiences. And sort of kind of laid the groundwork for this idea that, you know, religious experience is kind of an altered state of consciousness. And so that things that give us access to altered states of consciousness might give us access to religious experience. And that was part of the early debate. Like, you brought in Zahner. It's like, none of this, this is all just imitation. None of this is actual mystical experience. And of course, at that point in time, academically speaking, we didn't have nearly the knowledge that we have now of the role of psychedelic and mind-altering plants in multiple cultures for multiple purposes. So that's kind of a done deal at this point. It's like, we know, okay, that we can't just say taking drugs is some kind of aberration of the mystical experience or religious experience. It's been in religion all the way along. But it's still a new idea there. So I want you to tell us a little bit about that history and some of the trajectories, and then maybe we can get into like the CIA and things like that. But what was happening first?
Sure. So with one of the things that I noticed while researching this book was that when you read anything, you know, any kind of book on psychedelic history that focuses on the 60s, like Storming Heaven, Acid Dreams, a few others, nobody ever mentions that Aldous Huxley was not received very well by everybody when he wrote The Doors of Perception. When you read modern books about it, it seems like, oh, he wrote it and everybody was just... No. And one of the other things that I tried to stress in the book is that none of that would have happened without Maria Huxley. She's the real paradigm shifter here, because when you read The Doors of Perception, Huxley is on mescaline and, you know, under the care of Humphrey Osmond. And they're all talking about, you know, the psychotomimetic or the mimicking madness state or the clinical state. And Maria was the one like, no, fuck all that. Well, she didn't say fuck. She was like, it's all bullshit. No, okay. She was like, you know, forget that, you know, focus not on that, on madness, focus on the clear light of Tibetan Buddhists. And that is what actually, like, that is the linchpin that changed the trajectory, not only of Aldous's first mescaline experience, but of how the reclaiming of the mystical psychedelic, model happened in that moment. I got totally far away from the question you were asking.
But actually, maybe let's talk about this a little bit more. That there was
the Zahner thing. Sorry.
There was this idea originally that, as you say, that psychotomimetic, the idea that by taking LSD, that was one of the early interests, was like psychiatrists saying, oh, well, if we take LSD, it mimics schizophrenia and psychosis. And so we can learn more about how to treat people with psychoses by taking LSD. But then, as you say, that shifted more into this mystical model. So what was that interest? And maybe tell us a little bit about psychiatry at that time and what was going on.
Sure. So there were a few uses for LSD at the time, the early 1950s, actually beginning in 1949. The three that are very easy and obvious to trace are one, as you put it, that LSD gives you insight into the mind of a schizophrenic, or at least that's what was believed. As time went on, people stopped believing that because they would give LSD to patients that only suffered from like borderline schizophrenia, or it wasn't all the time. Like they would have, like episodes or bouts with schizophrenia, and they would take LSD and they came back and they were all like, no, like my bouts with schizophrenia are nothing like LSD. This is something totally different. There was also the idea, and this started over at Sandoz, like when they were first testing LSD, somebody had mentioned that it allowed them to abreact a memory. Abreaction is a medical term meaning remember a past forgotten event. And so the second possible use for LSD was, oh, to be able to retrieve like the foundation of traumatic memories, and then be able to work, from that foundation up instead of just scratching the surface, with traditional therapy. And the third thing people wanted to do, at least at the Boston Psychopathic Hospital, they wanted to try to invent some kind of chemical that reversed the effects of LSD. It was called a negative logic interpretation. The idea being, well, if LSD causes schizophrenia and we can undo that schizophrenia, like caused by LSD, perhaps that same medicine can undo chemical schizophrenia, like a natural schizophrenia in somebody else. So those three areas were by and large where the medical community was. And they all had different, things they were looking for. And one of the interesting things is that even though a lot of the patients and volunteers were not encouraged, and in some cases actively encouraged, to not have mystical experiences, they were having them anyway. And one of the funny things in the literature is when you look, and I've read all these different, medical papers from the 50s, when you start off 1950, 1951, 1952, it's like the references to these mystical things are like they're given short shrift. They're just like they're very much dismissed. But as time goes on and the accumulation of these kinds of reports becomes undeniable, the doctors start speaking about them more. But there's evidence that they were present pretty much right at the beginning.
Yeah, it was interesting, like reading through this, and you kind of have these accounts where, the people are brought in and they're given LSD and they're starting to have these experiences, and then the people running the experiment are like, well, actually, no, we need you to fill out this questionnaire right now. And like kind of thing, like today we would just say, do that afterwards. Generally you don't want to be involving people in like questionnaires and surveys in the middle of their trip. But that was sort of the approach originally, but then kind of making more room. Now in some of the earlier research was done with mescaline and psilocybin, it seems, or maybe I'm getting the timeline. I know mescaline was synthesized first. Maybe psilocybin came
That was the
after.
later 50s. Yeah,
Yeah, a little.
psilocybin would have been around 58 or so, 57, 58, because Wasson didn't bring it back from Oaxaca until at least 57.
Yeah, okay. But then with mescaline,
Or thereabout. The book came out in 57. So let's say, sorry, 50, between 55 to 57, somewhere around there.
Yeah. So LSD had already been synthesized. Mescaline was already in the mix a little bit. What were some of the early approaches to mescaline?
Very much the same with LSD. They were looking for mostly to at least see what kind of effect it had on the mind. Mostly that's what people were looking for. And this gets more into the CIA stuff because they were looking for some kind of brainwashing chemical. Like that's mostly what they wanted it for. Whereas the doctors were looking to just explore, this, to them bizarre, state of, just being.
Yeah, and And I like how you point out in the book as well that sort of the origins of our knowledge of mescaline, you know, really comes from James Mooney and what was created as the Native American church, and that that was all during the temperance and abstinence movement in the United States, where mescaline was likened to alcohol intoxication. And this is actually still a major feature of the Native American church today, is that peyote is consumed to help people stay off of alcohol.
Yeah.
And that that was one of its kind of origins. Then later LSD kind of got involved with Alcoholics Anonymous and sort of, you know, this therapeutic approach, this idea that actually this is something that can help with these other forms of addictions, and that it's something very different, that these chemicals are very different than these more opium addiction or alcohol addiction, that it's not an addiction and it's also not a madness, and that perhaps the therapeutic potential is at least in part these abreactions, right, of reliving traumatic events, and then also the mystical side of how that changes people and their relationship to their vices.
Yeah, well, yeah, the whole thing was that the people that were the people suffering from alcoholism that ended up having mystical experiences, they were the ones that were more likely to stop drinking and stay, you know, done with alcohol, whereas the ones that didn't have the mystical experience were more likely to go back to alcohol, which is also, so that's another funny thing where the original idea wasn't to give alcoholics a mystical experience. They wanted to give them delirium tremens. Like they wanted to give them like the feeling of what, you know, when you're of detoxing, and make it really uncomfortable and scare the shit out of them. And look, this is where your life is going. And instead they're like, oh my goodness, I saw God. I really need to put down the bottle. And they're like, whoa, that wasn't what we were fucking trying to do, but it worked. You know, it was just a lot of trial and error. You know, nobody at the time, I mean, to this day, I mean, do we really know what's going on with LSD? You know, it was still so new. So people were just trying anything. I mean, it was just a lot of Hail Marys until something stuck. And then they're like, okay, we got a little something. Let's go with this.
Yeah, and this was also the time period where we're kind of first introduced to some degree, this idea of the subconscious, that we have things that are happening at the conscious level of the mind, and then there's this strange, mysterious, enigmatic subconscious, and then sort of these breakthrough experiences that people are having. And that's where, you know, the psychiatrists are in there is like, wow, well, maybe this is what is giving us access to this sort of mysterious realm that we haven't seen before. And then can we map this out? Does it have, like, it was interesting reading through that about how there were different sort of maps made of, well, there's this level of, you know, conscious material, and then the unconscious personal, then maybe archetypal. And then we get differences between the Freudians and the Jungians about, maybe if you want to tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. Yeah. It's what's so interesting is that you can see the, even if they weren't aware of it, but the influence of the doctors, whether they were a Freudian or a Jungian, and how they approached, you know, the psychedelic state. But that changed mostly. The big change, I would say, came with Margaret Kuttner, Dr. Margaret Kuttner, who joined the staff at Powick Hospital over in England. And she was, from what I could tell, the first person to see the visions caused by LSD as Jungian archetypes. And again, that really, that had a tremendous impact on how doctors handled people going through, you know, bad trips and, you know, rough rour. I know we're not allowed to call it a bad trip anymore, but you know, they happen. But yeah, so, you know, you have also with Rosalind Haywood, who was that psychic medium. And of course, you know, she took mescaline under the direction of Dr. Wilhelm Meyer Gross in 1952. And she you know, explore the insanity, you know, explore, you know, because they were still in that psychomimetic paradigm. And she was like, oh, actually, I talked to like the great mother goddess instead. And of course, the Freudians were like, oh, you didn't have a good relationship with your mom, so that's why you saw that. And the Jungians, oh, that's just the archetype of the Great Mother. And the Catholics were like, oh, that's really just the Virgin Mary. And it's like, you know, everybody was just so quick to be like, oh, well, this is what's really going on. And it's like, well, you know, she's the one that had the experience. Why don't you go with her interpretation of it? You know, it's just, you know, we see it today too. It's like, if you make a post on social media, like the most innocuous post about anything, like the sky is blue. Well, how do you know the sky? Like, what about this? But everybody has to jump on and tell you their, you know, excellent and totally infallible opinion on whatever your thoughts are, you know? So. Yeah.
Well, it's interesting. It's almost like the Rosarch test, right? That here we have this enigmatic phenomenon, and then all these different people are putting their different lenses on it and say, no, it's this, no, it's this, no, it's this, no, it's this. And then meanwhile, we've got the CIA and the military in the background. It's like, how can we use this?
Yeah.
What can we do with these interesting chemicals, and how can we mess with people?
Well, the first thing they wanted to do, it's weird because they had to change it up too, because LSD just was not cooperating. But there was when we talk about mind control, it's not like, oh, the CIA wanted to try to control people's mind. Like there's a history of trial and error and failure and trying again and eventually failing. But the original purpose of LSD and mescaline was to get information out of an enemy. Like any, you know, a POW or whatever that you capture. It's like to get something out of them. But that didn't work at all. So then they're like, okay, what if we could use this as kind of like a psychic cyanide capsule? You know, this isn't, LSD won't be useful to make the enemy talk. Maybe it could stop one of our guys that gets captured from talking to the enemy. Like, so if you don't take a cyanide pill, you take some LSD, and then whatever information, you know, they get from you is going to be worthless. And of course, that didn't work either. So it's like, but it's interesting. It's like they had no idea what to do with this. Like the Central Intelligence Agency, with all the available resources, had no clue what to do with LSD.
Yeah. And also tied in with all of these sort of early years that you talk about in the book is the spiritualists and the channelers, and of course even the CIA was interested in the possibility of ESP and extrasensory perception, and you know, can we use these as spy tools and channeled information and all of this, and it's just such an interesting mix of all these different elements, at where LSD and the of course, the mescaline, psilocybin are sort of playing these roles of, you know, really opening up that question of how can we use this? What kind of information are we going to get, and how do we apply it? And just how much interest there was across many different disciplines, and of course, again, the government, all around these novel experiences, and the interpretations, the layers and layers of interpretations of what it's all good for, and how to use it.
Yeah.
Sorry, that's not a question.
It's all good. I think there's a question. Yeah, I mean, but it goes back to what we were talking about, that it's a bunch of people kind of like fumbling with a ball, like a hot potato kind of thing, and just hoping that, you know, somebody would figure this thing out. And I mean, to this day, I mean, well, one of the things I argue is that, like, so there were three paradigms created, or at least pushed during the 1950s. The medical, the spiritual, and the weapon. And of those three paradigms, the one thing that we can say for certain doesn't work is the weapon paradigm. So let's focus on the mental and the spiritual, the mental health and the spiritual health, which are, I think, pretty, you know, they're pretty laced together in some areas. I think that we're also, I mean, today we're kind of getting like, I don't know. We're losing. Never mind. That's a totally different. Never mind. No, that'll just tailspin us into somewhere we don't need to go. So never mind.
Okay. Well, then let's go back to sort of the mystical question. And
sure.
I like your description of how it was actually Huxley's wife that kind of steered Huxley in that direction. And you know, we sort of have this unlikely character of the Tibetan Book of the Dead, which, you know, the Bardo Todol, which was, I think, originally translated through the Theosophical Society. I forget the guy's name. I forget his name. But it was, the sort of the famous translation of the Tibetan Book of the Dead, and just sort of this interesting role that it plays in psychedelic history that that was kind of used as a roadmap to these psychedelic states. And it is, it's particularly interesting because at the time, you know, 1950s, I don't know how much even the intelligentsia really knew about tantric Buddhist tradition. Other than through the lens of the Theosophical Society, which also, you know, kind of comes from this perennial philosophy view of that, like, all the esoteric traditions of the world, they all relate to the same stuff.
Yeah, it's kind of almost like Orientalism in a way.
Yeah, yeah.
Like where we're inventing this.
Yeah, and this is, you know, to point out one of my favorite things that I always like to kind of harp on is, like, this is actually the same place where we get this idea that chakras, right? Always mispronounced. Everybody always says chakras, but they're chakras, if you're actually going to use the Sanskrit word. But that is from the Theosophical Society that we get the idea that the chakras are these rainbow colors, which is not Buddhist or Hindu or anything that was made up by the Theosophical Society. But this idea that all these esoteric traditions, they're all about the same thing, so we can just blend them all together. And then that was also the sort of the interpretation of the Tibetan Book of the Dead, which served a very different purpose, like, in Tibetan society. I mean, you read that book to the corpse, right? That's how you use the book. But now they're trying to use it as, like, a psychedelic guide. And I'm just wondering, like, did you uncover, like, sort of the trajectory of how the Tibetan Book of the Dead became so popular within this group of people?
Sure. Yeah. And just real quick to clarify, the reason the chakras need to be colorized is so that you know which energy crystal works with each chakra.
Right. Right. Which is, again, not Hindu. It's not Buddhist. No. But I mean, that's the way it's sold. That's the way it's packaged and marketed to Western audiences, that, yeah, the colors are related to different crystals, and none of that has anything to do with Buddhism or Hinduism, where these things actually come from. You know, so it's just part of this history of cultural interpretation, cultural appropriation, and, you know, reimagining things according to the culture's values in which it has been adopted.
Yeah, it's like, there, and I will get to your question, but it's like, I have that video called Whitewashing Maria Sabina, because there's that poem that goes around that people attribute to Maria Sabina. But it's like, there is, like, I studied Maria Sabina pretty in depth. There is no way she wrote that poem. It was very, that poem, do you know which one I'm talking about?
No, I don't.
Well, there's, if you did a Google search, like, Maria Sabina poem, it'll come right up, and you'll read it, like, there's no way she wrote this. Like, because you speak Spanish, right?
No, I don't, no.
Oh, you don't? Oh, I thought you did. Okay. Well, anyway, the point is that there's no, and I mean, she spoke, was it Oaxacan anyway, or some, Mazatec, excuse me. Oaxaca's where she lived. Wow. Sorry about that. See, this is what sleep deprivation does. As far as the Tibetan Book of the Dead, getting to your question, so it just so happened to be Maria Huxley's favorite book. That was really all it is. And there was, what happened was, as far as why it became this thing within psychedelia, had to do with a mistake that I hope I corrected in Wonder Child, which was this idea that Aldous Huxley read the Tibetan Book of the Dead to Maria as she died. That actually never happened. What did happen was he was telling her different ideas about, like, that could, you know, that jived with the Tibetan Book of the Dead, but he didn't actually read the book to her. What happened was a friend of Maria and Aldous named Eileen Garrett, who was like a psychic medium, later had a dream about Maria visiting her and talking to her about the Tibetan Book of the Dead. That was picked up by Timothy Leary. And then you pointed out he and Ralph Metzner and Ram Dass, or Dick Alpert, I prefer to call him, but Ram Dass, whatever. They wrote the psychedelic manual, a guidebook based on the Tibetan Book of the Dead. And that's where it really came out. And I don't know if you've ever read it, but I read it to write my undergrad thesis on Leary, and it was just kind of like, it's just psychobabble. Like, I didn't really get much out of it at all.
Yeah, I have not read his version of it. I've read a few different translated versions of the Bardo Todal, from Tibetan into English, you know, that's where my interest came from. And, you know, it's one of these really interesting things where it's become, or at least in this time period, it was kind of this major, quote unquote, psychedelic book. But actually, if you go into Tibetan tradition, that is not even necessarily considered a canonical book within Tibetan tantric Buddhism. That's a book from the old school of Tibetan Buddhism, and it's a minor text. It's not any of their major tantras or have anything to do with any of the main monastic practices. So it's just kind of this minor book within Tibetan Buddhism, but then, you know, it got reinterpreted as like, oh, here's this guide to these deep psychedelic states. And again, it was a book that literally was read to dead corpses.
Yeah.
So that they could navigate the bardo between death and the next rebirth. So it had a very specific cultural role within Tibetan culture, and of course didn't have anything to do with psychedelics. It was all about the stuff you encounter after you die, according to Tibetan Buddhist metaphysics and cosmology.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because Leary, they tried to tie it to ego death was the whole thing. But you know, that's the power of good marketing. You know, this book that had nothing to do with eating LSD at all, you know, so like that's what people, you know, and, you know, now we have this idea that, oh, well, you know, the Tibetan Buddhists must always be eating all kinds of psychedelics. It's like, I mean, that's so far outside of my field. Like, that's, you know, you're going to have to ask like Chris Bennett about, you know, that, or, you know, one of those cats that deal with the more Eastern traditions that I don't really deal with that at all.
Yeah. Well, and even the book itself that, like, again, I haven't read Leary's take on it, but a lot of the book, I mean, because it deals with, of course, the clear light, you know, that's the, you know, the sunum bonum, you know, that's the absolute goal that you're reaching for. But first it goes through all of the peaceful deities, which are great and nice and friendly and happy. And then it gets into all the wrathful deities, and they get worse and worse and worse, with more and more heads and more teeth and more eyes and more gore and blood and guts and destruction. And I've always thought, like, that would be the worst fucking thing to ever read to anybody.
I know, right?
Tripping. It's like, and let me tell you about the thousand armed demon that is, you know, drinking the blood from your heart. It's like, and then recognize that as yourself.
Yeah.
So yeah. Now that I've loaded up a lot of really bad imagery into your mind, no, just recognize that as yourself.
Yeah.
It's all the clear light. It's cool. It's cool.
That's the punchline.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting, though, you know, the whole, you know, how the way we, you know, adopt and readapt spiritual, you know, philosophies and ideas, and just turn them into things that they're not. Even just somebody like when someone will say, like, you know, like, oh, well, traditional ayahuasca use. Well, what do you mean? There's no such thing as traditional ayahuasca use. Everybody has their own different things that they do. Like, you can't call, I don't know. Again, it goes back to that whole perennial philosophy idea that it all, you know, springs from this one area. And, you know, even a cursory reading of history or anthropology demonstrates that that just isn't true.
Yeah. And even the anthropological concept of like anything being quote unquote like pure, that, you know, all cultures have been interacting with all their neighbors forever.
Yeah.
Things cross from one culture into another. And so to, you know, to find something like, oh, well, this is like unadulterated, this is the real tradition. You know, it doesn't really exist. It's not out there anywhere. That there's always diversity. There's always cross-pollination. There's always sharing and reinterpretations that happen with all of those sharings. And so, you know, there is, you know, like in religious studies, there's the term of syncretic religious tradition. It means like, well, this religion borrowed stuff from here and borrowed stuff from there. But, you know, when you really look at any religion, well, then they're all syncretic.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. To some degree, of course.
Yeah. I mean,
but that doesn't make it the perennial philosophy, but they are syncretic. Like, I agree totally with that. There's nuance there.
Yeah. But that there's always cultural sharing in some manner or another that's taking place. Or, you know, even if, again, if we're talking about Tibetan Buddhism, well, Buddhism didn't start in Tibet. You know, it's not a Tibetan tradition in that sense, that Buddhism came from India. India is not Tibet.
Yeah.
And 1950s Psychiatry in the United States also is not from India.
Yeah.
And is not from Tibet. But, you know, they're taking this book that's been translated into English. Evans Wentz, that's the guy who was part of the Theosophical Society. He created the first English translation. It was Evan Wentz. And that later scholars have come along and said, well, actually, he introduced a lot of interpretation into his translation, which, of course, you as a translator, you know, that's probably a very difficult question, that when you come up with a term,
yes,
like, how do I put this into English? And like, yes, so, I mean, how do you, yeah, let's talk about that. How do you deal with that? That you look at text in the original language and then you're like, well, okay, well, how do I put this into English? What is that process of translation, and how do we create, or is it even possible to create fidelity to the original when we're translating, especially from something from hundreds or thousands of years ago?
Yeah, it's difficult. I'm lucky because I mostly translate Latin. That's my main research language. And translating from Latin to English, it's not like trying to translate a concept from like Arabic to English or Sanskrit to English. So I got off easy with that. I mean, mistranslations also happen with certain texts. And this one I actually brought up yesterday with Dennis McKenna. There was a, for a long time, there was a translation of a text from around the 1120s, the early 1120s, the Common Era, that describes heretics having what we would call an entheogenic experience. Now, the problem is a guy named Edward Peters translated this text and he messed up a crucial verb. The verb is propinatum. He said, the sentence, let me just say it in English, is these heretics were spreading. So the verb is spreading, or a gerund, I should say, was spreading a deadly poison, right? The thing is, the word for spread in Latin is propago. Like, we get the word propagate from propago. Propinantum doesn't mean to spread. It means to drink in ceremony. So the sentence doesn't say these heretics were spreading a deadly poison. It says these heretics were drinking in ceremony a deadly poison and having visions of angels. They called it Kelius Kibi, the heavenly food is what they called it. It was this thing that they ate that gave them visions. But if you don't, like, if you have the wrong word, if you translate propinantum as propago, you have a completely different, you know, statement being made. But when you correct the translation, I know this has nothing to do with LSD, the Wonder Child, but I'm just trying to give an idea of like what translating is, yeah, like, and why it's so important to read these things in their original languages, because that ended up being one of, to this day, I think it's one of the clearest pieces of evidence for medieval entheogenic heretics, or medieval heretics using entheogens, I should say. And all because that one word was mistranslated. And I couldn't believe it when I saw this. I actually sent it to Carl Ruck, because I might disagree with him on the mushroom and Christian art question, but I will never disagree with that man when it comes to linguistics in ancient Greek or ancient Latin. Because he, that dude reads ancient Greek and Latin the way you and I would read an Archie comic book. I mean, it's child's play to him. And I mean, he wrote back. He's like, yo, this is a great fucking, like, yeah. Like, it's absolutely, propinantum means to drink in ceremony. Like, his translation is wrong, yours is right. And I was like, wow, that's awesome.
So. Oh, well, I think that that's a great example. And especially coming from a relatively uncontroversial language source, Latin, that, as yeah, you say, it's not that different. It's not that far away as if we were, yeah, dealing with some of the Sanskrit or Tibetan or, you know, ancient Chinese or something like that. But if one word completely changes the entire context of what we're talking about, you know, that just shows the importance of why accurate translation is important, why we do need to look at the original languages and we need to look at these original sources. And again, that's why your role as sort of this psychedelic historian is a very important role within contemporary psychedelic culture, because not a lot of people are doing that. Yeah. So it's fulfilling a need. thing.
I mean, I hope it's fulfilling a need. I don't know how much people actually need this, but I enjoy doing it. Like, I love the detective work. When you make those discoveries, it's so awesome. Like, it was another one I found where, I mean, it's clear as day. This was a medieval clergyman, and he's talking about people having psychedelic, what we would call entheogenic experiences with using solanaceous plants. And it's clear as day that that's what he's talking about. And this passage had been alluded to in some books that are written by people who don't want there to have been a witch's ointment. And so I saw a few, I'm like, so wait, what is this? And I went and checked the reference. I was like, oh, no wonder you don't want this to get out. This completely destroys your entire argument that there was no witch's ointment. I mean, this is the smoking gun. So that was another thing that was, you know, it was a lucky kind of find of, wow, you know, this is, you know, people really were doing this. And, you know, these guys were talking about it. And, you know, again, the number one rule of history is you need to have multiple sources of contemporary attestation. And, you know, you have a bunch of them now. Dating to the Middle Ages, that I think shows pretty clearly people were using this stuff and using it in ways that we would call entheogenic.
Yeah.
You know, not just recreational or medicinal, which they did too, by the way.
Yes. Yes. Which you've done a great job of documenting. So getting back into the 1950s.
Sure.
Let's talk a little bit more about the mysticism problem. And so, we've already mentioned the name Zahner. And so he's someone who was involved in religious studies and kind of comparative mysticism, was one of these early scholars of comparative mysticism. And his opinion was, you guys are not having mystical experiences. Yet they're saying, we're having mystical experiences. So what was that debate about at that time?
Sure. So so Zahner had three different kinds of mystical experience that he recognized. One of which was the panhellenic, which just means like a general kind of like that's what Aldous Huxley had, this general kind of oneness with the universe, right? Then there's the monistic, which is when you're, let's say, playing in a band and all of a sudden, like you're in the middle of the song, you're jamming out, you literally forget that you're playing guitar, like you're just gone. You know, you're playing all the notes properly, you know, muscle memory's all there. But it's just, you're not, you've just left. You know what I mean? Does that making any sense at all?
Yeah.
Crazy person. Okay. And the third kind is the like religious or like deeply spiritual, but he in the sense of of an organized religion. And the problem with Zahner was that he only believed that the, like, if you were not having a Christian mystical experience, then you weren't really like, or I should say Christian or one of the major Abrahamic religions.
Right.
It either had to be an Islamic one, a Hebraic one, or a Christian one. And anything outside of that was like, oh, that's like those old Gnostics with their love potions. We don't want that, you know? For him, he said that Huxley's experience was just, it sounds bizarre to him. It doesn't sound mystical. It just sounds bizarre because Huxley wasn't talking about oneness with, you know, all of creation. He was talking about, you know, the interesting folds in his pants and the way the books looked on his bookshelf. And the one thing where I would actually, and I mostly disagree with Zahner in most areas, but the one thing where I did have to stop and take pause was he writes how it's like, look, most people, like most regular people in the 1950s, the kind of, you know, day workers and housewives that were the volunteers of LSD experiences, of these LSD trials, his whole thing is like, are these people really the best judges of what constitutes a mystical experience? Like, yeah, so they had something happen to them that they never experienced, right? Does that mean it was mystical? It's like you could get hit by a car. If it never happened, does that make it a mystical experience? Well, no, you know? So he had a point there. The problem with Zahner was that he very much overlooked, as you correctly pointed out, the deep history in Western culture we have of people using these things specifically for spiritual or ceremonial purposes. Zahner's whole thing was, oh, this is just what those those primitive indigenous peoples do. Yeah. He was quite the white supremacist. And one of, I mean, you know, his arguments against this stuff did not age well because they're pretty much embedded in white supremacy. He's saying, yeah, this stuff is good for those savages. They need it. But we white people, our souls are, you know, have evolved more. So we don't need that kind of stuff, which is really fucking cringy. I mean, you read it, you're like, like, yeah. Long story short, I think Zander was totally wrong. Except I do think he did make a good point about the whole idea. One, are regular people the best judges of what a mystical experience is? And two, I think that he was right that Huxley was completely incorrect about the perennial philosophy. Yeah. You know, and his arguments against the perennial philosophy, they're the reason that I don't buy the perennial. I think they're really good arguments.
Yeah, that he basically makes the argument that people get an experience that is in some way conditioned and sanctioned by their culture and the context in which the experience is arising. So he was one of these proponents of really looking at what is the cultural context. But as you say, during that time period, this was before what we now have is religious studies as an academic discipline, that these were kinds of their early origins before it became its own distinct area. And largely, comparative religious studies were done by Christian theologians coming out of that background. Sure. And so there was a very strong cultural bias that said, well, any true religious or spiritual experience is going to reaffirm the Abrahamic religious traditions.
Yeah, exactly.
And that everything else is actually somehow less than that, right?
Yeah.
And so at the bottom, we would have primitive indigenous people taking mushrooms and dancing around fires. But then even the Orientalists, you know, Buddhism doesn't quite get there. So maybe it's nihilistic or something like that. And that because they're not reaffirming a creator God. So yeah, they're spiritual and all that, but they're not as evolved as we are. And yeah, that there was even the importation of, what's his name? Charles Darwin, using that as cultural evolution to say that cultures move through, there's the primitive stage,
yeah,
right? And then eventually,
the magic stage, yeah.
And eventually they'll get to the monotheistic religion stage. And that would be the highest cultural expression of religiosity. And so that bias is there in that early work and in all of the comparative studies of religion. So, you know, it wasn't just Zahner that we can see this in a lot of different sources during this time period. And then that really changed when, you know, kind of like now, we're getting into actual psychedelic studies, that more university programs are actually developing courses around psychedelic studies. And the same thing happened with religion, of that, well, actually we've been using our cultural blinders of what counts as authentic religious experience and then applying that to everybody else without really looking at them on their own terms.
Exactly. And in that way, I think Zahner was correct. Other than it was, you know, it's like you have to say, again, there's that nuance. I think he's correct, but as you know, separating it from the white supremacy part of it,
yeah,
he is correct that they are, you know, all these different cultures. And in a way, you know, it respects the cultures more when you don't try to rewrite them, which is, you know, one of the things that I, you know, kind of got on about in my, you know, whitewashing Maria Sabina video. It's just, you know, you're not actually respecting who this woman was by pretending that she's a yoga instructor from San Diego, which is, if you read the poem that is falsely attributed to her, I mean, and you're smart, you're going to read that and be like, no, this was written by a yoga instructor living in Southern California, because that's exactly what it reads like. I mean, there's no, I have no question of that. Or obviously I have some questions. I don't know who actually wrote it, but I know that Maria Sabina did not. And it's, you know, it's pretty obvious she didn't, I think.
Yeah. So that's a great entry. Let's talk a little bit about Maria Sabina and sort of the entry, sure, of psilocybin into, sure, the modern psychedelic mix. Cause you know, she is someone that is highly revered in many ways. And I think that she's also quite the tragic figure in the sense that it seems that from her perspective that her relationship with the mushrooms was ruined
Yeah.
By all of this interest from outsiders. So maybe we could talk a little bit about what happened there. And I'm sure many people listening know about Gordon Wasson and all of that. But give us a little refresher, if you don't mind, Mr. Sure. Psychedelic historian.
Well, one of the things I did a little differently in Wonder Child was mostly, like, when you read books about the famous meeting between Wasson and Maria Sabina, it's always written from the perspective of Wasson. It's always written from the perspective of New York banker goes to Oaxaca, eats mushrooms, bring them back. What I wanted to do, and what I did, I hope I did, I should say, in Wonder Child, was tell that story from the perspective of Maria Sabina as just this simple healer that all of a sudden has her entire life upended and uprooted by this guy coming to try her mushrooms, you know, and we overlook that a lot. The tragedy of what happened to her, the mushrooms stopped talking to her, a whole bunch of tourists, you know, psychedelic tourists, you know, invaded Oaxaca, trashed the city, well, the small village, trashed her house. And the mushrooms stopped talking to her, she said. You know, she tried eating them again, and they just stopped working, which is, phenomenal in and of itself. And, I mean, it's so sad that, but, like, from, like, a spirit science perspective, I would so love to be able to investigate. You know, I'd love to have gone back to that time and sat with Maria Sabina and, like, asked her these questions, like, what is going on? Why are they not speaking? You know, like, what do you think is happening? She was quite a remarkable woman, and one of many that from the 1950s who really changed our perspectives on psychedelia. In fact, one of I'm hoping if we ever have conferences again, the speech that I was working on, because I think this far ahead about things, the title is Two Marias. And it's all about how Maria Sabina and Maria Huxley actually completely changed the paradigm of psychedelia in the 1950s. And they're, you know, Maria Sabina isn't overlooked as much. I would say that she's not appreciated because people try to rewrite her as like a white woman, which is just is nothing but disrespectful. But, especially somebody like Maria Huxley was completely overlooked. And yet she was, the linchpin, really. And when you put those two Marias together, that was really the reintroduction of the mystical model into Western civilization.
Yeah. And it's interesting how it is kind of a reflection just of the patriarchy of the time as well.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and even the privilege of someone like Gordon Wasson, you know, that a white man can go into a remote village in Mexico and fundamentally disrupt this woman's relationship to her healing practice and her chosen medicine of the mushrooms. And of course, you know, Maria Sabina, she couldn't do the same. She couldn't just show up, you know, in New York and, you know,
of course,
you know, so there's that interesting imbalance there. And just the fact that Maria Huxley has, you know, that as you described, it's like the story has been that the influence went from Aldous to her, but you're saying, no, it actually went the other way. And,
absolutely.
You know, just uncovering these little aspects of history, I just think are very significant and very important to kind of reframe all of this.
Yeah, so here's another one of the tidbit on that, and as you read in the book that maybe your listeners might not know if they haven't read the book, but when Humphrey Osmond first gave Aldous Huxley mescaline, Maria's best friend, Annie Wesley, was there, but she's a black woman, so she was not added to the Doors of Perception. But we know from Huxley's letters that she was there. So it's another one of those things where it's like, here this woman was, and it's one of those, again, this odd nuance, because it's like, obviously, Aldous didn't have a problem with her. Like, there wasn't a racial problem here. I mean, it's Maria Huxley's best friend. I mean, they did everything together. And, you know, there's no indication that they held. I mean, Aldous was the opposite of R.C. Zahner. Aldous is saying, look, it's white people that have lost their souls. It's these other cultures that you would call primitive that are actually the more advanced culture. So he didn't seem to have that same kind of supremacist attitude that Zaner had, but at the same time, he actively chose to leave Ani out of the account.
Yeah, so there's just an invisibility.
There's that invisibility. And for somebody like me, who's a huge Aldous Huxley fan, it's like that you don't know what to do with that sometimes. You know, I don't want to make excuses for the guy, but you try to understand what might have been happening. I mean, he also didn't, like, he was dishonest about the clothing he was wearing. That's another thing. Like, he talks about the folds in his trousers, right, in The Doors of Perception. But he didn't wear trousers that day. He actually wore blue jeans. And Maria said to him, "You're going to look like a slob for your readers. Just say that you were wearing pants so that you don't embarrass me." You know? So that's something else that it's like that's in The Doors of Perception. And again, not a big deal.
Yeah.
But also it's like, yeah, it's like, oh, even down to the pants he was wearing, he altered that for his audience. And I think that he might have been scared to say, oh, look, I was assisted by our friend Ani Wes, who happens to be a black woman.
Yeah.
I mean, this was the 1950s. So maybe he thought there'd be a black. That might have been something else for his enemies to latch on. And be like, oh, look, you're hanging out with one of them, you know? I don't know, obviously. And again, I do not want to make it sound like I'm making any excuse for Aldous Huxley. It's just a weird thing in history that, you know, we do have to confront, you know, and we have to face this historical fact that did happen. And, you know, how do we make sure that everybody isn't just brushed aside or made to be invisible as we create this new story of the psychedelic Renaissance?
Yeah, I think it's kind of this tragic story of this woman whose spiritual practice really was destroyed by all of this outside interest. Yet, I don't know if that side of the story, I mean, I know that people are aware of that, but I don't know if it really gets told enough.
It doesn't.
You know, and then if she gets repackaged as, oh, she's giving us, you know, New Age advice. And mm-hmm. then, I mean, we modern American, whatever color we may be, we are not her audience. We are yeah. not her community. We are not who she was serving. And that was imperiled and destroyed by the attention of outsiders. And mm-hmm. and it's great. We got psilocybin mushrooms from that. We got awareness, really, of psilocybin mushrooms from that. And for that, I'm grateful. I've enjoyed psilocybin mushrooms. And so perhaps I have Maria Sabina and Gordon Wasson to thank for that to some degree. But there was a cost to that.
Yeah.
And she paid that, unfortunately.
Yeah. That I was going to say that we didn't have to pay, like she paid for that. And, you know, it's one of those, like, you don't know how to feel about it kinds of things.
Yeah.
Like you don't you know, am I happy that, you know, psilocybin mushrooms have been brought back into West? Yeah. But I mean, does my heart break for Maria Sabina? Of course it does. And it's like that, just that weird duality of life. Or you're a non-dual, so never mind. it's just, you know, how do you, you know, it's all about, you know, how do we weigh these things?
Yeah.
You know, how do we weigh that, you know, Aldous Huxley left Ani out of his account? You know, how do we weigh that? How do we weigh that, you know, Bob Marley was, you know, a political revolutionary who was also, from, you know, some accounts, was also a spouse abuser. How yeah. do we weigh that?
Yeah.
You know, and I think the best way to weigh it is to say that, you know, people have flaws, and it is, I think, the struggle of our time is separating the art from the artist, or separating the piece of work from the person who created it. Can we do that? You know, or is that person's just essence so wrapped up, you know, in what was done? Like, can I watch the first Crow movie ever again, even though it was a Miramax film and that was Harvey Weinstein's film company?
Yeah.
So am I allowed to watch that movie? I don't know.
Yeah, it is. It's this very sensitive time around all of these issues. And it's, you know, that's part of the information age, where we live in this ecology where we get all this information about people. And, Really what it reflects is that, look, being human is hard. It's hard. We all encounter struggles and problems, and some of us are indoctrinated in dark ideologies of supremacism or whatever it may be. But even for the best well-intentioned, well-meaning people, that people fuck up, and it's hard. It's hard being a human being. And I'm a non-dualist, but the non-duality is actually the recognition of the polarity of the extremes of being, and realizing that it's all part of the same package in that sense.
Yeah, it's kind of like a continuum.
Yeah, yeah.
Sure.
So I'm going to have to run really quickly because I got to pick Jaden up from school. But
sure.
I just really wanted briefly just to touch about the CIA, that I think the name was Olson.
Yeah.
And that there was a show on Netflix. I can't remember the name of the show.
Wormwood,
yeah. So that's what I wanted to ask you, because one of the things that I like to kind of monitor is where psychedelics are showing up in popular contemporary culture. Most recently, there's been this show on Hulu, Nine Perfect Strangers, which features like microdosing, and it's a completely inaccurate depiction of microdosing on the show. But it's just something that it like caught my attention, and I actually reached out to the— it's a show that's based on a book, and so I reached out to the publicist for the author to see if she'd come on my show to talk about it. I haven't heard back from yet. I don't know if I will. But so Wormwood, is that an accurate depiction of that, the Olson story of the guy who jumped out the window, as far as you can tell? Or
so one of the frustrating things about this is that when Olson hit the ground— this was outside the Statler Hotel, in New York City, in Manhattan. When he hit the ground, he didn't die right away. And he said something to the, I guess it was like the bellhop or the concierge was right, like ran outside to get him. And he told them exactly what happened, but that person did not understand it. Like he mumbled, like, as he was dying.
Yeah.
So he had literally his death confession right there. And unfortunately, the guy said, I couldn't make heads or tails of what he was saying. So, pushed or jumped? I lean more towards pushed. Again, with history, we're always dealing with probabilities.
Yeah.
The problem, and I go back and forth with this, so what's going to happen is I'm going to say I think probably push, and then I'm going to start saying why, and then I'm like, actually, now that I think about it, he might have jumped. Like, that's how I tend to go. Like, I shouldn't do interviews anymore, because somebody asks me a perfectly honest and legitimate question, and I'll give them this, and then I'll think, well, actually, you know what, I'm probably wrong. It's probably this other thing. So I think it was more probable that he was pushed. This happened a week or so after the LSD, and, we don't really have reports of somebody taking LSD and then 2 weeks after deciding, oh, this was the worst mistake of my life, I need to kill myself. We also have to remember that at the time, LSD did not have the stigma it has today. So you wouldn't have somebody saying, oh, I took LSD.
Right.
I ruined my life. How could I face my family again? No, all those guys took LSD and went home and, still, had relations with their wives and helped their kids with their math homework, So you didn't really have that as a paradigm. Again, that doesn't mean that maybe Olson had some underlying mental health issues. I don't know. Damn it. I shouldn't give interviews anymore. I'm so bad at this. I wish I knew, but I'll say, for the sake of, you got to go pick up Jaden, let's say probably pushed out the window. But I'm not sure.
All right. Well, we can leave it there. And that's a good historical honesty. So thank you, Tom. Thank you so much for your time and the conversation today. Just remind all the listeners out there, we're talking about LSD, the wonder child, the golden age of psychedelic research in the 1950s. Just another great book by my friend, Tom Hatzis. Thank you for writing it. Thank you for doing the research. Thank you for your time today. Love you, Tom. Miss you. It's great to see you here, and really enjoyed getting a chance to sit down and chat with you today.
Likewise, brother. Till next time.